Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:07 a.m. on Thursday, March 12th, 2026. And present today, it looks like we've got everyone: Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We have one item on the agenda this morning, and that's Senate Bill 64. It's the elections bill by Senate rules. Today, we'll have the final opportunity for questions. Wanted to make sure that we invited Ms. Carol Beecher with elections so that folks would have an opportunity to ask questions. And after that, we'll review the updated fiscal notes, and then we will set the bill aside. So with that, I'd like to first of all invite Senator Wilikowski as well as his staff, Mr. David Densmore, to the table to take questions. If you could put yourselves on the record, and Senator Densmore, Senator Wilikowski, you got a promotion, Mr. Densmore. If you'd like to provide any comments before we take questions, you're welcome to begin. And also, we do have Ms. Director Beecher with the Division of Elections available for questions. So with that, take it away.
Thank you, our Representative Foster, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage. I don't have any comments. You've had the bill for some time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Does the committee have any questions for Senator Wilikowski or Division of Elections? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilikowski, for being here today. I was looking through the bill, and there's a few items in the bill that I just had a question about for the sponsor. And specifically, when we look in the bill, I don't have it in front of me here yet, but when we look through the bill, there's some timing when we talk about when we send notices out. And in that timing, it specifically has to do with the ballot carrying portion. There's a timing period that's been established for the purposes of when a notice is being done and when we send out information. But I think there's a bit of ambiguity in the bill of when the division is making notice of a deficiency in the ballot. So, for example, right now when we go to look at these ballots, the board has to convene and do the review of these ballots. And so I'm just wanting to understand from the sponsor's perspective what the intent was for when these notices, this 24-hour period for review actually should begin.
Mr. Densmore.
Good morning. For the record, David Densmore, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the timing for the notices for curing are found in Section 24 on page 12 of the R version. Within 24 hours of the ballot being reviewed, the director is required to notify if they have a phone number and email for the voter to inform the voter, and then within 48 hours to mail the deficiency notice. The reason for the mailed notice has a different time than the phone call and email is if the ballots are being reviewed on Saturday. Since there's no postal service on Sundays, it wouldn't be possible to do that in 24 hours by mail. To your concern about the timing of the review process elsewhere in this bill, the ballot review process is to start 12 days before the election instead of the current 7 days, which would allow these cure notices to be sent out earlier for ballots that have been received earlier.
A follow-up?
Follow up.
Thank you, co-chair and through the chair. So, yeah, I appreciate that. I'm just trying to think like functionally when we talk about when we do reviews, because I know that we did in the bill move up the period and when reviews can actually start. But that doesn't, the bill doesn't clarify exactly when those reviews have to happen. So usually you convene the board and they do a review. That could happen once a week. We might be able to start 12 days prior, but then you might not have it for again for another period. And I'm not aware that in law there's any prescriptive time period and when those review boards have to happen. So if we're trying to be proactive on ensuring that every ballot that's coming in is being reviewed and that a cure might may or may not need to occur, that the notice is being sent. So I'm just so I guess the question was that the intent would be that we would start at the 12-day period, but there is no framework or requirements in the bill that there's anything beyond that. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Dinsmore?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the bill does require that the review period start 12 days before the election. You're correct. It doesn't specify once it's begun, specifically how often or on what days the boards will meet. I think it would definitely be the intent that the Division of Elections should be able to work this into their current process. The normal way they handle the review is when the ballots are received, first the division staff will go through and log them, and they will make a preliminary determination of how they expect a review decision to be, and then the board will review it, and if there's any discrepancy between what the board and the staff determine. For the issues that are curable, these are pretty straightforward. Missing signature, or missing witness signature, insufficient voter identification. These would be things that the division staff would be able to flag during their logging process, and I think it would be the intent that ideally they would begin the notice at that point.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, quick question for process.
Sure, Representative Martin.
So appreciate the sponsor of the bill being or the senator carrying the bill is here with his staff to answer questions. The department is here as well. Do we know, will the senator and his staff be available after we have an opportunity to question the department to maybe for some follow-up questions of the sponsor of the bill? Is that part of this process today?
Yes. So you're thinking if we go to the Division of Elections, is there an opportunity to come back to the senator? Is that your question?
Yes, sir. I think that's what I'm trying to get to, because I have a lot of questions that might be able to actually be answered by the division, and that might kind of be self-evident by the time we have those questions, instead of trying to ask the sponsor of the bill questions when the department's actually here.
Yes. If we could, and feel free to stay up, Mr. Dinsmore, Senator Wilikowski, Ms. Carol Beecher, if you could come up to the table and put yourself on the record, and Representative Bynum, if you've got questions, then I think you've got questions as well, Representative Hannon.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. Actually, what I was going to ask was for the Division of Elections to describe for us the review process currently, because I suspect that they either have a regulations that guide what they do currently and what would happen, you know, we're given more time, and whether they would then expect to have daily reviews or every other day, or how it fits into the current practice, and if it's not in regulation, if it's just in their operating procedures, and thought, you know, it may not be in statute, but I suspect, because most things with the Division of Elections, there are very set procedures for how things are done, even if they're not prescribed in statute.
Maybe if we could go ahead and set that foundation and get some clarity on that. Ms. Beecher, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carol Beecher, Division Director of the Division of Elections. The process for the board is basically as outlined already, which is that the staff look at all of the absentee ballots that come in, and as to note also that these absentee ballots go to the regional offices. So each regional office then reviews the ballots that come in, excuse me, the absentee ballots, and they make a preliminary look at any kind of error that could potentially cause the ballot to be rejected. That then goes to the board, and the board then reviews that to make a determination on whether or not the ballot can then be sent to Juneau or opened and then sent to Juneau.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. So I'm just trying to make sure that when we talk about having this open period 12 days prior, you know, that begins to start the process, but that we also have clear definition about what our expectations are. Or I guess, and that could be a little open for interpretation of what the expectations are for how often or how frequently we want to make sure that we're actually doing these reviews and sending out notices, because obviously timeliness is very important for many parts of the state, specifically rural parts of the state. And so I think that that's the basis of that question. So I appreciate the answer. I did have I can take a step back, Mr. Chair, for just a moment. I got quite a few questions, but I want to make sure that I'm not dominating all the time.
Maybe let's, before we go to another separate topic, is this the same topic, Representative Hannon? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Beecher, could you describe in a little more specificity how often that district review board would be counting them so that we get down to this curing process timeline within those 12 days? Is that likely to happen every day, every other day, or only once during the 12-day period?
Ms. Beecher?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it is not actually set on a specific time frame. The ballots, as they come in, the regional supervisor makes a determination essentially based on the volume of the ballots that come in, because they're calling in the absentee review board to review those. So it depends on the volume that arrives, and they make that determination. So it is somewhat fluid. For Anchorage, obviously, they meet much more frequently. In Nome, they may only meet once or twice based on how many absentee ballots are received.
Follow up?
Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Beecher, would it be helpful for us to get more specific in the statute in applying a standard, or is that within your latitude and you feel like administratively with budgets and differences from region to region, that flexibility for practical reality should remain as it is in the statute currently?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Hannon. The division would certainly prefer that there not be a set time, because each region is different. And if there were set times of requiring the review, that would require us to pull in the boards to review when there may be just a few there to review, which would be a waste of their time.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Moving on to kind of a different topic, when we look at sections 34 and 35 of the bill, we have effective dates in here. Right now that there is section 34 is for section 11 of the act, and it's a effective date of January 1, 2027. That's specifically for the true source part of the bill, and under Section 11. And then Section 35 is basically saying, except for that section, that this act would go into effect on July 1 of 2026. So from the department's perspective, are there any challenges that we would face with the bill effective date being July 21, 26, and our ability to actually follow the law that we'd be passing?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the challenges for the division on the effective date are fairly specific to the requirements for the online system that bill tracking and for the curing, which are married together in this, that if one passes, it's a conditional provision that then the other needs to pass as well. So in order to implement an online system, which is what is required by the statute, and that it has to be easily used through a mobile device, and it has to have multi-factor authentication, to be able to do that from the July 1 effective date and have it in place for the August primary would be not possible to do something that it was a system. And that is because the time frame is so short. There are only 49 days between July 1 to the primary election. And we're in the middle of the election season. We only have two IT staff, and their efforts at that time are based on making sure that the VREM system, our voter registration system, is properly functioning, as we get a lot of registrations that come in during that time. So it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the division to implement something that was tested, that was reliable, and that we made sure that the public knew that it worked properly, because the cure process would require that the division is able to document and have an auditable trail of the contacts with the individuals who may have a curable ballot, so that we knew for sure that we had contacted them timely and that it had happened appropriately. If we didn't have that in place, it's potential of somebody coming back and saying, you never contacted me for a cure, and then we would be in that situation.
So follow up.
So thank you for that. I appreciate that. So what I hear you saying is that you believe, from a practical perspective, the ability to actually execute would be very limited. Has the division had any conversations or discussions to say that if this actually did go into law the way it currently is, based on the challenges that you have, what kind of legal impacts this potentially would have within the division?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have not had the discussion with law. We have had the discussion internally on what if this was if we were required to implement a system, how would we do that? I believe that we would be in violation of the requirements of the ballot tracking component right away, because we cannot do an online system in that short of a time. Could we do something in a manual way? Yes, but that would not be what is required under this section.
Follow up on that item.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Through the chair. Is there, when you go out in there and you look and see, I'm assuming that we've kind of tried to look and see what other states are doing in this space. Is there specific systems that are put into place, or are these being developed by their own within the divisions themselves?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have not looked at all of the states. Some of the states employ a off-the-shelf system. Most of those states that do that, from the information that we have, are states that have by-mail ballots, by-mail elections. Alaska is quite different in that because of the paper ballots, and we don't have by-mail elections for the regular elections. So I know that they employ something in Anchorage as well, but that is also a by-mail election.
Okay, thank you.
I have more questions, but I'm going to wait. Maybe other folks will have questions that will answer some of my questions. I don't want to dominate all the time.
Okay.
Co-chair, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Beecher, we haven't had the pleasure to meet. I'm Andy Josephson from Anchorage. My question relates to Representative Bynum's question. If the last words of the bill, if we changed that effective date and moved it up, where would you hit a point where you could comply? Would it be April 1?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the ability to do it in this election season would be nearly impossible for the division. When this bill was originally introduced, our fiscal note made it really clear that any kind of a system implementation would require the bill to pass in 25, so that we had the rest of 25 to develop and implement, because it requires procurement, requires testing. In order for it to be a system that can be dependable and that the public can trust, we need the time to be able to do that properly. So the idea was that if the bill passed in 25, we could certainly implement it. If the bill was required to be implemented so that we could build this online system in 27 for the 28 elections, we can also do that. But to expect it in the election year for 26, we don't believe that we can do an electronic system as the bill speaks to at this time.
Follow up.
If there were another section to this bill that said that made this electronic system have an effective date of mid-2027, but the manual portion be effective for the coming election season, is that manageable? And to the extent what I'm describing doesn't even make sense, let me know. But could we do the part where people telephone someone in Western Alaska and say, you're missing a witness signature?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, speaking specifically to a process to be able to contact individuals, the division could do something manually during the 26 elections. But the cautionary component of that is that tracking that and ensuring that we had an audit trail to be able to document for individuals who may respond that the division had not reached out to them to cure their ballots would be a challenge.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay. I've got Representative Galvin and Allard, and then we'll come back to Representative Bynum. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I think probably I'm going to sound repetitive because I don't understand enough about the work that that all of the election systems is doing. But I want to make sure that I understand that the piece that you just mentioned around that we could manually do some of the work of curing ballots and calling Western Alaska, for example. I'm trying to understand the volume that we're talking about. How many in the past have you seen where we were not able to do this process?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we don't currently have a cure process, so the division has never attempted to reach out to any voters during elections. They are notified after the election if their ballot has been rejected, but we have not tried to notify them prior.
Can you give me a sense of, if through the chair, if I may,
Senator Galvin,
of the sheer volume of those who you have had to reach out to after the election, for example, in an area like Western Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, these will be estimated numbers, but I can provide you with hard numbers.
Estimated is fine.
We would estimate that for the cure process, looking at the general election from 2024, mm-hmm. for the curable items currently in this bill, that there were probably under 1,000.
Okay, if I may.
Representative Galvin.
So we would be talking about the manual portion of it. Should we choose to try to piece something together that would hopefully address the concerns of that region, it would be a matter of roughly 1,000 or so folks that you would need to contact. And then I think you referred to mailing something to them as well?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, that the statute as written requires that the division would call them if we have a telephone mm-hmm. number, and that we would text them, and that we would mail a letter to them. So all of those things, according to the current version of this bill, require all of those things would have to happen. And for rural Alaska, the number of rejected ballots is much lower than Anchorage, for example.
Through the chair. So the number 1,000 or so was for the whole state?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And so when I think about this problem that we have of not maybe having the integrity that you would like to have, should we have a full automated system in place, I also think that something is better than nothing. And so I'm trying to understand like what it would look like from your perspective in terms of the people to put that in place. So if it were me, for example, I do a lot of things grassroots, and we get a lot of parents together and try to we reach out to thousands of people sometimes in one night. And so I'm just trying to understand for you, for what you would need, because it would need to be paid staff. Is that insurmountable to reach out and do the calling and the texting and a follow-up for 1,000-ish?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, it is something that we, if it were not automated, mm-hmm. that would probably be done on an Excel sheet with check marks mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. that we contacted them on this date, right. That kind of thing. For the rural areas, we know from our experience with the different precincts that we have, mm-hmm. it can be really difficult, if not impossible, to get a hold of people via phone. And so phone, email, same thing. So it would require the mailing of a letter, and the timeframes, as you'll see in that portion of the statute, as listed for notifying individuals would make it really difficult because of mail timeframes. So if the division has 5 days in which to mail something from the point at which the division knows that it has a curable issue, if we mail it after 5 days, it could take 5 days to get there. They have to have it. We have to have received it back within 10. So we don't believe that the mailing of it, even from the day of election, would necessarily allow the individuals in those communities to be able to send back the information required to cure the ballots.
One follow-up, if I may. Uh-huh. Thank you. So I've had experiences with my kiddos who are not in state, and they forgot about the deadline. They had no idea what they were doing, and I didn't have access even to a fax machine, and so they ended up having to go to an office to do that. But they were able to get in whatever form it was, whether once it was a PFD and once it was around voting. And so I just wondered through the chair if I understand it's not perfect. I understand the timing is terrible, because I've tried to send things to Kotzebue and the mailer got there long after the election, for example. But it sounds like it might capture some percentage of these voters who have not had a chance to get their vote in. And would they not be able to, if you have texted and you'd emailed and you sent a letter and there's maybe only 3 days left, could they not do something through a fax machine or some other way to get whatever curing you needed done? Or is it only a mail back to you? Is that the only way that's fixed if they live far away, for example?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, according to the way the statute is currently written, they would have to be able to provide us with the required information that was missing from the ballot mm-hmm. Within, so that we received it by 10 days. So it would be a contingent on them on how they were able to send that to us. So yes, if they were able to access faxing or imaging it in some way to get back to us, that is a possibility. The challenge is that if the only way we were able to get a hold of them was through the mail, on whether or not any ballots that were curable that required us to go through the mail system could be cured within the 10 days post-election.
I promise this is my last one.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing then, I think, is sort of worst case scenario is if they have to be mailed in from you and then mailed back. So if those are the only options they have to get information to you, then that time frame is very difficult. However, if either you've had luck getting through to them through these other processes and they have these other processes then to get back to you, or they have a a daughter or someone with a cell phone and can take a picture and then text it or, you know, things like that, then that is fixed, or that time frame then is no longer the big obstacle. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes. In that world, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Before we switch topics with another question, Representative Hannah, did you have a question on this topic?
I did. Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Beecher, we do have in our files, and I believe this is from the Division of Elections, this data flyer. It says www.elections.alaska.gov, and it's ballots rejected for witness signature. So if all deficient ballots in round numbers that you're using off the top of your head, so we're not holding you to an audit on that, was 1,000. This says that 512 were rejected in the 24 general election for inadequate witness signatures. Does that seem accurate to you, that about half of our ballot rejections are from inadequate witness signatures, and then half are from the other causes that could be curable?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, if we're speaking to the issues that are curable, yes, those numbers sound right. I'm not familiar with the exact flyer that you have, but yes, that sounds right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Just want to note that we have with us Senator Kawasaki visiting House Finance today. Welcome. Let's see here. I've got next in the queue Representative Allard and then Bynum. Representative Allard.
Thank you. So this is a totally different topic, like you said, Chair. So through the chair, Mrs. Beecher, I just have a couple of questions in regards to Section 3 on page 2 of the bill. Can you just explain to me again, how would we be able to verify U.S. citizenship?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, in regards to Section 3, I'm not seeing that has to do with verifying citizenship, but in Section 4.
Is it? Okay, thank you. I thought in the second.
I'm sorry, Section 8.
Okay.
Section 8 will require the division to use the System Alien Verification for Entitlements program.
Okay.
That program, which is known as the SAVE program, mm-hmm. That's being used by 26 states across the country currently. I believe it's 26 as of today. And what that system requires the division to do would be to send the voter rolls, the entire list, with the date of birth, the last four of the social, and the full name of the individual. The SAVE program then filters that, and if somebody has a United States birth certificate, then those are not flagged. If they are flagged and they have an alien number or things like that, then the system will let us know that. But if someone does not ping their system as having enough information to let us know whether or not they're a naturalized citizen, mm-hmm. then they come back to the divisions and they require more information. For example, the full social security numbers. Alaska's Division of Elections has full social security numbers for almost every registered voter because of the PFD data. So then it would require us to send those to them, and then they do a deeper dive on a manual process, which can take my understanding currently is they say 10 days, but my understanding is it's taking them about 30 days to manually review those records.
Follow up.
Okay. I've heard a lot of testimony, especially I think in the other body, that people were very concerned of their information being sent to the DOJ. And in that, it was the last four. Was it the date of birth also included in driver's license? Okay, so this system that's in this bill, is the SAVE Act ran by the federal government then?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, yes, the SAVE system is under the Department of Homeland Security.
So even though the DOJ requested the information, technically this bill is going to provide that same information if needed.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, may I do a couple more follow-ups? Thank you.
Representative Allard?
So currently in the state of Alaska, I think it's $50, maybe it's $20, could request any and everybody's information in the entire state of Alaska who's registered to vote and market to them however I see basically fit, in the sense that I have their name, their address. Can you tell me what I don't have when I go to speak to individuals, market to them, send them flyers, whatever I need to do? Can you help me with that? And can you verify, is that just, that's anybody in the world could request that information from Division of Elections?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, anybody can request the public voter list, and they purchase that for $20 from the division. They can do that on a weekly basis because, you know, the voter list is a live document where we're continually cleaning it out and updating it. The information that they would not receive on that would be things like the voter number, the voter ID number. That is not public. It's confidential. The date of birth is confidential. The Social Security number, any amount of that, four numbers or all of it, is confidential. So those are components. That the residential address, if it's been marked as private, that is also confidential.
Just maybe two more follow-ups.
Representative Allard?
What about their driver's license number?
Yes. That's sorry, through the chair, Representative Allard. Yes, that is also confidential.
Okay, so that I'm clear. May I? Thank you. The information for the state of Alaska to verify one's U.S. citizenship goes through the same process of the information that we had sent to the Department of Justice. And then all the information except to voter ID, date of birth, Social Security number, any numbers on that, last four or the whole number. And the driver's license number is the only thing confidential. Everything else is open to the public to get information to market to anybody in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, there are a few other columns, but they're not really germane to identification.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. In the lineup, I've got Representative Bynum, Stapp, and Josephson. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just as a quick note, you know, a lot of times when we think about rural Alaska, a lot of times we're referencing Western Alaska, but there's many areas of Alaska that are rural, and I represent a lot of those. So I just wanted to make it very clear, when we talk about issues with communication throughout the state, it is throughout the whole state. As an example, Northern Prince of Wales, there's many areas of Northern Prince of Wales that have no cell phone reception, and that's where people are living. So communication can be quite challenging, and mail is very challenging. So just wanted to kind of put that on the record, that let's keep in mind that we have a very large, vast state of with a lot of rural residents, and that creates a lot of challenges. When we talk about, we had a conversation earlier a little bit about talking about how we can implement ballot curing. Could we do an ad hoc type system? I get a little nervous when we talk about having an ad hoc system in place, because I want to make sure that we have equal protections for all of our residents equally, not that we're just providing good service for those in urban areas, but we are leaving an equal opportunity to not only vote, but to have our votes reviewed in the form of the ballot curing process. So with that being said, for the ballot curing process established under this bill, giving unchanged existing statutes and the proposed new statute here, what would you say are some of the ballot curing process issues that might arise, or what would it look like specifically for an absentee ballot where a cure is needed with related to a witness signature?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the challenges that we see with the addition of adding the witness signature as a curable error on a ballot is that it conflicts with AS 1520081D, which states two times in it that an absentee voter shall sign the voter certificate in the presence of an individual. and then says, who shall sign as a witness and attest to the date on which the voter signed the certificate in the individual's presence. So the division is not clear on what the legal ability of an individual who has already sent the ballot to the division. It's in the envelope. How would they cure a lack of a witness signature, because the witness had to have signed it to have witnessed it? So we're not sure how that is possible, and feel that this conflicts with AS 1520-081D.
There's a follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate that. I think that's definitely something we'll take up as a further discussion. I hope that we take up as a further discussion from the committee and also with the bill sponsor to kind of get a better idea of how we work through that particular issue. But with that being said, the utility of the witness signature, there's been a lot of conversation about the witness signature and what it actually provides as a value to this process. And I was hoping that you might be able to at least tell us a little bit about maybe why we have a witness signature in place currently and what real value there is from the division's perspective on validating an actual ballot for having it. I have my own opinion, but I was hoping to get your opinion, at least on kind of the genesis on why we have it and what is the utility for it actually being there. How effective is it really in determining that a voter that signed it, put their identifiable information on it, that it's actually doing something functional?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So the witness signature, I believe, follows the whole idea of the importance of voting, and that it's really important. So it requires that somebody says that when you're not in front of anybody else, that you were the one who actually filled out that ballot. The United States and many countries, and clear back into biblical times, put a lot of weight on the oath, and many things were required to have a witness. You have witnesses when you're married to sign the marriage certificate. You have witnesses when you are in court. It's an established element of trust that something happened. We have notary publics for a reason, because they're witnessing that the person who signed that is who they say they are. Now, whether or not somebody takes that seriously is something for those individuals, but we believe in the division that most people in Alaska have a lot of integrity, and that they would not sign an oath or have somebody sign an oath if they were not actually witnessing the signature. So are there those bad actors who may be signing their own, or things that the division cannot detect? Probably. But the idea is that it is committing perjury. It is not legal to do that, and that people are going to take it seriously because they take voting very seriously. So there's an intrinsic value in having somebody sign that they witnessed you putting your ballot into your sleeve and completing that action. The other alternative, as the division sees it, if you do not have a witness signature for a ballot, to make sure that the individual who filled it out is actually the same person that you sent it to, would be to have some sort of signature verification system. And that was in some previous versions of bills, that was something that was suggested. It is an option. It's an expensive option. And I don't know the exact history of how the witness signature came about, but I am guessing it was because it's really difficult to do the signature verification. It requires expensive equipment. When we checked that earlier for an earlier bill, it's around $1 million for each of those systems. It requires regular training of staff who only work necessarily every 2 years. So it's a lot more work to verify a signature.
A quick follow-up.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So with that being said, when we talk about an oath of of verifying or an oath of saying that this is me on our ballots currently and under law, or if, even if I'm going in person and I sign the registry or I sign my ballot, there is some legal weight with that, is there not? That is now on me, the voter, to say that I am who I am, that I have a valid ID when I go into the voting polls, or if I don't, that I can vote a question ballot, because we have an absolute, you know, we have that absolute right that we want to make sure people vote. But isn't there already in statute and in law that says when I'm signing that, I am giving my word, and that we do hold weight in that in all facets of our legal system and also with the state? Because there's many other systems that we have to go into for the state to verify and sign that it is me doing it and that I am now legally responsible for that as an individual without a witness signature?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes, the voter signs an oath and affirmation that they are who they say they are and that they have properly filled out the ballot.
Okay. And then there's one follow-up.
Representative Bynum?
In the history of the program that we've had witness signatures, how many witness signatures have we had where we've actually identified and or, identified, I'll leave it with that, identify that we have known that there's been an actual fraudulent event that occurred? Of the hundreds of thousands of ballots over the many years, how many instances have we as a state actually identified that was a problem and prosecuted for an invalid witness signature?
Representative Bynum, to my knowledge, there has been one prosecution that was successful in somebody doing something nefarious in their witness signature line.
Okay. And as a follow-up to that, how many other instances have we had where there's been identification of fraud where the voter or the non-voter signed a document and sent it in?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't have that information here, but I could provide that as a follow-up.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm trying to stick on topic, but I'm also trying to make sure that we've give folks who haven't had a opportunity to speak yet do so. So I think I'm going to stay with my lineup here and go to Representative Stapp, and then we'll go Representative Shragi, Josephson, and Allard. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Beecher. Almost messed that up. Thanks for being here. So I just kind of want to hammer down on the privacy stuff, just probably to kind of think about that, because it's relevant to page 5 of the bill, I think. But so my first question to you is, State of Alaska is currently in ERIC. Is that correct, through the chair, ERIC system?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. The division participates in ERIC.
And fault, Mr. Kocher.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you. And is it 26 other states that presented ERIC to that were with through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I believe now there are 26. I could be a number or two off.
And fault, Mr. Kocher.
Representative Stapp.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think being in ERIC, we supply all of these states with our voter information as well as our voters' date of births, our voters' driver's license numbers, and our voters' last digits of their Social Security. Is that correct, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the process with ERIC is different in that the divisions or the elections bodies that participate in ERIC send their information to ERIC, and it is hashed, and the information are the voter rolls and the DMV data. Those both are sent to ERIC by the states, and they have a system in ERIC that then uses their system to sort it out by the state. So the states are not receiving it from another state. The states are getting the information from ERIC based on the matches of the hashed information that has been provided by each state.
And a fault, Mr. Kutcher. So when you say a DMV data, I mean, that means driver's licenses and Social Security numbers, that type of stuff, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, correct.
Okay. Fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Representative Stapp.
Who are these ERIC people? Where are they? I know what the system is, but I mean, where are they based out of? You know, obviously our constitution has strict privacy laws, and we're talking about aspects of SAVE, which is kind of a similar purpose in this bill. So I'm like, where are these ERIC people based out of, and like, who runs them? Through the chair.
Through the chair, the Representative Stapp. The ERIC system is composed of members that have to be the states that are participating. There are no non-state members except the small ERIC staff, I would say, and the head of that is located in Seattle. And I believe that they have a programmer who may be located in Colorado, but I can provide you that information.
Okay, just so one last follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Scott?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Foster through the chair. Yeah, reason I asked a question regarding ERIC is we've been at it for a while, and I'm just curious if you knew, were there any constitutional privacy concerns about sharing this information with people when we initially went in with ERIC?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I am not aware of those questions, but I do know that a statute was passed that added on to 1507-195 to allow the sharing of the data in the way that is required by ERIC.
Okay, and last follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to Ms. Beecher. Do you see anything in this bill? I assumed if we did it through ERIC, we can probably make these changes too, and all, you know, warm and fuzzy if we had to change the statute to be able to kind of put us in line through the bill. You don't see any issues with the state's kind of privacy laws and kind of sharing more information like we already do through ERIC, do you, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, my understanding is that under the Constitution, there is a Privacy Act, but that Privacy Act also specifically says that the legislature has the ability to have statutes that define the levels of confidentiality of information that are allowed to be shared. And those vary depending on the needs of the various departments and are specific to those. In Alaska, it's 1507-195 that lists those. In some other areas of state law, it might list that the names are considered personally identifiable in information. That is not the case with our voter list, because we send out the voter list and clearly it has the names of the individuals. So the legislature has the ability statutorily to make those determinations.
Okay, and just a quick clarification, Mr.
Representative.
Yeah, so just to be clear, there's nothing in this bill regarding that you think that there's any issue regarding that. Is that a fair assumption through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, if this becomes law, then that would be the will of the legislature under the Constitution.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Schrage next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. To the bill sponsor or staff, the Director Beecher mentioned some inconsistency in how the witness signature cure process, and how there's just some inconsistency in curing that and what the original witness is intended to do. I was wondering if the bill sponsor or his team could provide some perspective on how you see that concern. Thank you.
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Schrage, I don't believe there's an inconsistency in the statute. I'll point the committee to Section 22 on page 11, which says that during the state review board process, the ballots that have been cured will be counted. So they'll be counted during the state review board process, not during before then. And then the procedure for curing the ballots is found in Section 24, and it's subsection B that defines what a voter has to provide to cure their ballot. They have to confirm that, yes, they did in fact vote that ballot, and then they have to provide an identification, which would be acceptable under 1515-225A, and that's in Section 14 of the bill, actually narrowing down to only specific government IDs that can be used under that subsection. But that is the voter will be providing their identification to verify. So if the intent of the witness signature is that witness is verified that you were the person who voted, that statutory purpose is being served by the voter providing an identification and These are, in fact, going to be the only absentee ballots where the voter will have been required to have provided an identification. So those cured absentee ballots are going to be the ones that have been the most verified as to the voter's identity.
Okay, thank you. I have another question, but on a different topic, so down the line.
Okay, maybe what we'll do, we're going to go Representative Hannon next.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Beecher, I wanted to return to the idea of what the the purchasable voter roll includes, as opposed to Representative Allard asked for what was excluded from it. But I'm hoping you'll put on the record, when you purchase it, what is included. My understanding and experience is its name, address, some mailing addresses only, some mailing and residence address, party affiliation if you have it, and then frequency of voting. Is there anything else that's included in that database that I'm not thinking of when you purchase the voter rolls?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the public list includes the party, the district or precinct where the individual is located, their first, last, and middle name, and suffix if we have one, the accession number, the registration date, the origin of the registration, that date, the district date that they moved into that district, their residence address and mailing address, their gender, and their voting history.
And one follow-up. What is the accession number?
It's just a number that's attached to the voter. That's a public number. It's not the voter ID number that you get when you have your voter card.
And just a follow-up. Mm-hmm. And that accession number is really just an internal number that you would keep track of. It has no other bearing to reality in any construct of who I am. Or
through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got in the queue, I do have Representative Josephson, Allard, Bynum, Schrage, and Galvin. Did I miss anyone? Okay, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Beecher, I wanted to come back to Section 8 of Version R and discussion of the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements Program. Couple things. You said you mentioned the number 30 days to manually review the data. You said something about that system, the SAVE system, not to be compared to the SAVE Act, I know they're different things. If that system were to flag someone as possibly not a citizen, there would be, you noted, a 30-day opportunity to review manually the flagging?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the 30 days that I'm referring to are what has been reported to the states that have submitted data to the SAVE system for the individuals that are working for the SAVE system to do the manual process of verifying whether or not that individual is a citizen. It's not something, to be clear, that the divisions are doing. It's something that the SAVE program is doing. And they try to do it within 10 days, but we were hearing that it's taking up to 30.
Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Director, it's the taking up to 30 part that concerns me. So if you're in that all-important October window and you're a new citizen to this country, could a person inadvertently or accidentally be deprived of the right to vote?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, an individual whose name is not on the register can go to vote a question ballot, and that allows the division time to review that information. And so they still would be able to vote, but they would have to vote a question ballot if they were not on the register.
Follow, Representative Josephson.
There was an article I mentioned in the previous hearing on SB 64 from ProPublica. You probably saw the article, you may have. It highlighted, I think, rural districts in Missouri, possibly rural in Texas, where county officials like yourself, essentially similar jobs, but at the county level, had noted that there was more deprivation, they found, there was more deprivation of the right to vote than exclusion of non-citizens, and that the net effect was, on a deprivation scale, it tilted deprivation. I guess my concern with the systematic alien verification program is that, as I understand it, it would be the first time ever where there would be a database that was designed by the CIS office, an arm of DHS, and that would commingle entitlement information, but now also citizenship and electoral information. There's a draft MOU. It's lengthy. And in a couple places, it says, for example, in two that I've identified, it says that the DHS USCIS reserves the right to use information from the user agency. So that's you, for any purpose permitted by law, including but not limited to the prosecution of violations of federal administrative or criminal law. So the concern that's been raised by conservative organizations, in my mind, conservative organizations, is that where election data used to be principally a state function, now we're linking ourselves to a federal function, and we're not even, one could argue that a single deprivation of the right to vote is enough to sue over, but also to raise all sorts of alarm bells. But I suppose one could argue if there were 1,000 non-citizens voting and one person deprived, awful for the one person, but maybe a net societal benefit. I'm just concerned, based on what I'm reading, that this system, the SAVE entitlements program system, simply doesn't have any net benefit, and that it's already the law that citizens can't vote. Do you see this, given the other screening devices, filtering devices noted in Section 8, is this an absolutely critical component?
Ms. Beecher.
Chair Representative Josephson, the state currently is not a member of, or has not signed an MOU and working through the SAVE system. We do not see this as a critical component for the division to identify whether or not there are legal or illegal individuals that are voting. It is another tool that could identify those, but we don't, in the division, see it as a critical component for doing that.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Densmore, I think you might have had something you wanted to add to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to just quickly clarify that subsection where the systematic alien verification for entitlement database is listed would not add any authority for removing someone from the voter rolls. It lists documents that be or databases that are required to be consulted through the voter roll cleanup process that is established elsewhere in that section of statute. As currently written, merely having a not being able to verify someone through SAVE would not by itself lead to someone not being able to vote. Potentially, if through a query, the Division of Elections, learned of a death certificate for someone, that would be grounds to remove someone, but merely not being able to verify someone would not affect anyone's right to vote.
Okay, thank you. Let's see here. I've got, I want to try to include a couple of folks who haven't had a chance to ask questions yet. I think what I'm going to do is, I know Representative Allard's been waiting quite a while, so I'm going to go to Representative Allard, then we'll go to Representative Tomaszewski, Moore, Bynum, Schrage, and Galvin. Representative Allard.
Thank you. And this will be my last question. So I just need a little bit of clarification. If we can go to page 3, and it looks like through the chair, Ms. Beecher, or to the sponsor of the bill, it looks like that when you look at lines 10 through 13, and then probably all the way down, it's requiring 3 verifications before the Division of Elections would send out a letter. So, for example, they say who has not contacted Division of Elections for 2 years immediately preceding the examination of the register and who has not voted, appeared to vote in the last 28 months. And there's some weird conjunction thing here at the end that doesn't loop them all together. And I think that's just a technical error. It says immediately preceding the examination of registration. And then it lists all of those things below. So I'm trying to figure, I think what it's saying is, not think, what it's saying is that all three are required in order for the Division of Elections to send out notice instead of just one, because we changed an and or an or to an and.
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I will consult with legal to make sure that this is written properly to get the intent, but the intention is to be expanding the criteria that would allow a notification to, in addition to inactivity, also allow these notices to be sent to people who have indicated residency in another state.
And I appreciate that, but it, and just to be clear on the record, it is saying that all three are required, not just one of the three. And then I think my last question, Chair, it's different from this topic, if I may. Thank you.
Representative Vellard.
Is that on page 3, lines 26 through 28, it says maintained a physical address located outside the state for 28 months. Why would notice be sent to a physical address and not an including a mailing address for people that are like snowbirds, students, and temporary housing? Like if you're saying it only gets sent to their physical address, they're not going to get notice if they receive mail at a P.O. box or if they're out of state because they're snowbirding. Can you help me with that? And would the sponsor look into that? Maybe we can fix that as well.
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I would be happy to work with you on that. This, as I read it, that is just a criteria for getting sent a notice, but we'd be happy to work with you to clarify that.
Can I just ask to clarify? Sure. What do you mean being – okay. No. But if, for example, I use my mailing address as a place I physically look, so it's the same. But a lot of my neighbors – use a P.O. box. So, yeah, I look forward to working with you on that. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Willikowski?
What we're trying to do with this provision is expand the reasons why the division might look into a person who may not be registered in Alaska. And so this doesn't require that it be mailed to the person whose physical address is out of the state. What it's saying is, if you're registered to vote in another state, right now under Alaska law, you can't remove the person from the ballot rolls. That's crazy. If you receive a driver's license from another state, you can't just remove the person. And so what this is saying is that this triggers the event for the division to contact that person. And so what H is saying on line 26-28, which you pointed out, Representative, is if you maintain a physical address outside the state for 28 months preceding this, you will get a letter from the Division of Elections. If you respond and say, hey, I'm still technically an Alaska resident, I want to continue to vote in Alaska, you continue to vote in Alaska. But these are simply expanding the things for which a person will be sent a notice from the division.
May I? Thank you, Senator. I appreciate your response. And I'm just going to go back, and I agree with you on that. That's outstanding. I'm going to go back to, in reading the language, it says all three are required before Division of Elections. And I know that we're going to work on that together, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Next up, I have Representative Tomaszewski and Moore, Bynum, and Shragi. So, Representative Tomaszewski. Yeah.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and no need to change the page. I'm looking at that same section. When exactly do I lose my ability to vote?
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, under this procedure, which is compliant with the Federal National Voter Registration Act, if you meet one of this criteria that gets triggered a notice, you get sent a notice. You have the notice will be forwardable under current law. The state sends first an initial notice, and if you don't respond, they send a second one. This bill streamlines it to only a single notice. If you do not respond, you then get put on to inactive status, which under the National Voter Registration Act, Alaska is required to maintain a voter in inactive status for two general elections. And if you vote during that period, you will have to vote a question ballot, but your vote will count and your registration will automatically be activated and you'd be moved to active status.
Can you follow up?
Follow up.
Okay, so if you're telling me if I have a registered vehicle in another state and you send me a inquiry on my and I don't respond, then I will lose my ability to vote in the state of Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, no, you wouldn't lose your ability to vote. You would just be on inactive status, which would mean you probably wouldn't get political mailers because you wouldn't be on the active list the candidates would buy. But when you showed up to vote, you would vote a question ballot and your ballot would count, assuming you're still an Alaska resident and you swore to that.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up?
I would imagine a lot of people might want to get on the inactive vote just to not get all of the political mailers in their mailbox. But talk to me a little bit about H in that section's line 26 or 28. Maintain a physical address located outside the state for a full duration of the 28 months immediately preceding the examination of the register. So if I have a vacation home and I'm a snowbird and I go out, what is the limit? I guess, can I snowbird for 11 and a half months out of the year and still be considered an Alaskan resident and vote in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Densmore,
through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, you know, I think that those valid questions, I think we can work on clarifying it. I believe the intention, when this language was put together is just to try to capture the phenomenon that like happens fairly regularly. There's often people who Alaska assists other states by on our voter registration form, we have a checkbox that you check to tell the state to cancel that you want to cancel your registration in other state and Alaskan forms. Unfortunately, a lot of states don't have that. Specifically, Washington doesn't, which is probably a state where the most Alaskans move to. So it happens fairly often that people move to Washington and find out they're still on the Alaska voter rolls, often if they're registered in a vote-by-mail jurisdiction and receive ballots, they get really so that criteria was just to try to rope in, if people weren't roped in by the other residency indicators, a way to send these notices to people who have moved out of state but have not been removed from the rolls yet.
Okay, follow up.
Follow?
And maybe if I can just pose that to Ms. Beecher, the elections, like when do I lose my ability to vote?
Through the chair, Representative Thomas Juicy. Sorry. under current law, if the division has to send out two notices, the first notice has to be returned as unforwardable. If it is not returned, then those individuals stay on the voter rolls. And you may have heard some from our last cleaning up of our lists, we really are trying to get people who are getting notices to their houses for someone who's not there to return that to the division as undeliverable, because we know that we have approximately 20 to 30,000 names on the registered active list of individuals who are not active. So they continually on our list maintenance are sent those notices. So the first notice currently has to be sent back as unforwardable. The second notice, if we get that back as unforwardable, then can go out and then they have the 45 days to respond and they're moved to the inactive list. If they're in the inactive list for two general elections without any kind of contact with the division, any kind of action of voting, which would include signing a petition, contacting the division for an address change, all kinds of things like that, any contact basically. If they don't contact us, then they are then eventually could be up 8 years before they're actually completely removed from our list.
So follow up. So I can be out of state for all that time and still be considered have the ability to vote if I just continue. I mean, I don't have to be a resident.
Through the chair, Representative, the requirement under Alaska law, if you have an intent to return, then you can continue to live somewhere else and still be registered and vote in Alaska, as long as you do not register and vote in another jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. In the line, I've got Representative Moore, Bynum, Shragi, and Allard. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My questions are for Dr. Beecher. Through the chair, what's the annual cost of the ERIC program system?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, I can get you those exact numbers, but I believe that it's around $30,000 now a year that we pay to be part of the ERIC system.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up?
Let
me see here. Are there any concerns that the bill would create a conflict or jeopardize our membership with ERIC?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, no. We have not identified any concerns in that regard.
Okay, and one more follow-up.
Mm-hmm, follow.
So do we think that SB 64, if enacted, do we think any of the bill would make it harder for us to continue cleaning up our rolls? Using the ERIC system.
Through the chair, Representative Moore, as regards using the ERIC system, no.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. We've got Representative Bynum, Shragi, and Allard. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. You know, we want to make sure that we have access to vote, and that I believe that we want to make sure that access is equal. I think that having equal protection for our citizens is very important. I know there've been a lot of questions about the residency requirements, and I know the federal law and the courts have held that the time that you're in a state and how much you can restrict somebody under residency requirements is very limited. So, you know, I mean, although we might feel like somebody's out of state and not a voter or a resident, that the courts have held that time frame is very short, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, in Alaska, it's 30 days prior to the election.
Right. Another question that I have is really more on that equal protections time, equal protections ideal. Overall, there's many things in this bill that I really like. I like the idea that we are able to have ballot carrying in the bill because we have the same ability when we show up in person. But the functionality of how ballot carrying happens is important. I feel like we want to make sure that it is fairly and evenly distributed amongst our citizens. But given the current language in the bill and the size of our state, we have some time frames in here, and I was just hoping that the division might be able to talk a little bit some of the challenges of ensuring that the curing process is equally available, not only for those that might be living in an urban area, but those living in the rural areas, and specifically the 10 days to complete and return the information provided, and for the division to be able to functionally interact with ballots that are put into the curable status. Can you talk a little bit about where we might have some issues and with the current language of the bill and being able to ensure that we're applying equally the ability to cure their ballot, cure a ballot for those in urban areas versus those in rural areas?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the real challenge for the rural areas throughout the state will be for those individuals who rely on mail to do the cure. Those to get the curable information back to the division within the 10 days, because as it be received 10 days after Election Day, will be extremely challenging if it's possible for them to do it within that time. The division, the boards will have to identify that this has a curable error on the ballot. then within 24 hours, a division would attempt to notify. But if we can't, then it's by mail, which would ideally be right at the same time, but could be 5 days later. And depending on what's going on with the processing of those absentee ballots, if it's 5 days, any ballot, practically speaking, that was sent by mail to a, or I'm sorry, any curable notice from the division that was sent 5 days after election day, we don't think realistically that with the mail system and with the ability of the individuals in those rural communities to respond back, that there is enough time. And we, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say as a follow-up to that then, through the chair, trying to create a system where we have equal treatment, what is the recommendation from the division if you were to look at this and say, this is how we would recommend to fix that issue, if you could say?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we did do a cursory look at other states to see what states did for curing ballots. It was specific, frankly, to the witness signature on what were other states doing with that. And the state that was identified was Louisiana, that they require the individual to come in at least by the day before election in person to cure their ballot. So the broader question of curing, to make it, if you were going to try to make it fair for everyone across the state, no matter where they lived, it would seem to the division that you would need to have the ballots that were curable had to be received earlier than election day.
Okay. As a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So right now, when we have the way that I read the bill, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, is that right now we have 10 days to receive ballots, and that within the time frame, let's say day five after election day, we receive a ballot and there's an issue with it, whether there's no identifiable information, there's no signature on it from the person sending in the ballot, or there's not a witness signature, you then have this time frame that ticks off that says you must now send notice. We earlier talked about that there's potentially issues with the timing of those notices and how they're sent. The senator's office had responded basically saying that there's a concern about mailing on Sunday. My perspective is I don't believe that would relieve the obligation of the department to still send notice, whether that notice is being sent on a Sunday or not. That just means whether or not the carrier is able to take that mail, right? But if something comes in on day five, to me it feels like that is very obvious that you could still send notice to somebody that lives in Anchorage, for example, and they would maybe reliably receive that notice and be able to cure their ballot within the five remaining days, because it is cut off at day 10, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes.
But if I was sending that notice to somebody in, say, Prince of Wales Island, that the likelihood that they would actually have that opportunity would be pretty nil. Would
through
you agree?
The chair, Representative Bynum, that would likely be correct.
Okay. And then, Mr. Co-Chair, I did have one other question. I don't know how much time we actually have left here. Is it okay if I go ahead and ask?
Sure.
Well, I have a whole list of questions, buddy. I think that this is probably an important one. And this is probably a question for both Ms. Beecher and also the bill, the senator's office for the bill. And that is under Section 28. In the bill, we currently talk about the PFD application and how we deal with information from the PFD component of the application and with the division. I was just hoping that I might get a little better understanding of what the intended purpose of the change in language for how we're dealing currently in law with the PFD application and the communication to the division, and the change in this bill that would change that. I was just hoping that we could get a little clarity on what the intended purpose of the change was and how it might impact the division. And so probably first to Mr. Dunsmore and then second to Ms. Beecher.
Mr. Dunsmore?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, And this was a provision that I believe the intent of the legislator who brought this to our office was to have more data shared with from the PFD division to allow the Division of Elections to incorporate it in their voter roll cleanup and review process. Currently, the division only receives the data for people who are registering to vote through the PFD. And I believe the intention was that allowing them to receive, for purposes of voter roll cleanup, the other data would have some value. And there are several sections in the bill related to that and relating to making sure there's protections for that data.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the bill has, I believe, four sections in it that are specific to the permanent fund dividend. And the divisions read, and we would appreciate the clarification by the sponsors on this so that we would be implementing it properly, is in section three, which is on page two, it defines what the voter roll maintenance is. And that is confirming residency of a registered voter, identifying duplicate registrations and detecting voters who have moved, and detecting voters who are ineligible to vote under 1505. In section 28, it lists the type of information that is expands the information that we would receive from the permanent fund dividend to include the applicant's affirmation of residency and the names of contact individuals that verified that PFD, and the voter's registration status and whether they've claimed residency in another state. Currently, the division gets the entire PFD list every year after the March deadline. And with that entire list, we run that against our system to identify individuals who are new, so that we don't have them in our system yet. So those would be new registrants, or whose residence address has changed. If their mailing address has changed, we don't notify them, but we update their mailing address currently. If their residence address changed, or if they are a new registrant, we send them an opt-out notice. And that notice allows them to say, I want you to register me to vote, or I want you to either change or don't change my residence address. That's the data that we currently get. According to the way that we are understanding these PFD provisions in this bill, Section 30 repeals the ability for the division to use the mailing address to update our system for individuals that we get through the PFD system. So we would no longer be able to update a mailing address. And under the data that we currently get from PFD, we don't have any use for the contact individuals who help to verify. The division isn't sure what that information is intended to be used for. And the registration status of an individual would not be known by PFD. So we're not clear on exactly what is intended. It appears that what this in application would result in is that when the division got the PFD registration list after the March 31 deadline, that the only thing that the division would then be doing with it would be to send the opt-out notices to new registrants and to those who had a change of their registration address. That would be the only things that we would do. We would no longer update mailing addresses based on this data.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would like to maybe talk a little bit about our time. I was hoping nobody would notice, so thanks for the note, Representative Bynum. I was trying to go as long as we could. Our scheduled time was from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We're now at 10:36 a.m. And I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to ask all the questions that we want to ask, and also make sure that we've got Ms. Carol Beecher from Elections available to answer those questions. And I see we're also losing some folks too. And so I know that folks have prior commitments. I'm going to take a brief at ease and try to figure out how much time we have with Ms. Beecher and also what other slots that we might have. I'm looking at Mr. Brody Anderson. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay. House Finance back on record at 10:38 a.m. on Thursday, March 12th. I think what the plan is I think, let's see, we do have, let's see, Representative Schrage asked to have his name removed from the list. Representative Allard, I wanted to let you know that Mr. Andrew Dunmire from Ledge Legal was online in case you wanted to. Well, thank you. In case you wanted to ask him about page 3, and then I think Representative Bynum has a number of questions, and maybe Representative Schrage wanted to come back to his, in which case I'm thinking what we'll do is go to Representative Allard while we've got Ledge Legal on the line, and then we'll go ahead and adjourn. And then we do have a 9 a.m. tomorrow morning for the highly digitized bill. We'll probably take this up first while Ms. Beecher is here, ask any other questions that folks have, and then if we have time, we'll come back to the highly digitized bill, but if not, we'll set that one. We'll figure out something on that one. So, Representative Mellard, would you like to?
I'm going to thank you, and through the chair, these are probably just a quick yes or no, I think, for Mrs. Beecher. Ms. Beecher, when we're curing, if individuals need a cure, do we have a list? Would we have a list in this bill that anybody could access, like the municipality of Anchorage has, that we could walk in, grab the cure list, and call all those individuals that need to come in and cure whatever issues are wrong with their ballot?
And Mr. Dunmire?
No, to Mrs. Beecher, because she's going to be running the division. I just want to know from her.
Okay, Ms. Beecher.
Is there?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if I'm understanding your question, that the this would all be curing absentee ballots. Mm. So the absentee ballots are all sent to their various regions. We have 5 regions. So that's where the ballots would go. And then they would be reviewed by the staff for any clarification and making sure that they were registered voters, et cetera. And then they go to the boards. And the boards then make the determination on whether or not the ballot is rejected.
Okay. That leads me, can I? Sure. That leads me into another question then. If I walk in and I vote and they, and I take my ballot and I drop it in a box and somebody who's looking at my signature says, it doesn't match her driver's license. I have a long name. It's Jamie Allen Delfiero Allard. And they say it doesn't match. That would still be considered being able to cure my ballot. So it doesn't actually mean that it has to be via absentee, right?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the cure process is specific to the absentee ballots. When you go in and sign the register, that is not something that's curable per se.
Okay. And then back to the question then. So you're saying that, but if I was in that region, I could access a list of the individuals who need their things cured, correct? Is that in this?
Through the chair.
Like a printout that I could receive as a public member so that I could call the individuals and say, hey, your ballot needs curing. What can I do to assist you to have that happen?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that has not been contemplated.
Oh, okay.
The way that we understand it is that the individual would be notified. It wouldn't be something that would be made public.
Okay. And then just one last question, may I, Chair? I'm going to go back to the part with the Division of Revenue, or Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice, the way you see it, Ms. Beecher. In the Department of Revenue would get information on our voters. Is there a mechanism in place that prevents the Department of Justice or any other organization of getting that information from Department of Revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if you mean by the Department of Revenue, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division?
It could be both. But, I mean, we provide all the information to Department of Revenue in regards to voters, so...
Through the chair,
Representative. If you can clarify, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the process with the permanent fund dividend is that the individual, when they fill out their permanent fund dividend application, if they're a new applicant for the PFD, they note whether or not they want to be registered to vote, and on the form, and they clarify and basically sign an oath through that process on the PFD form. When the division gets the list from PFD, then we filter it for new registrants and resident addresses to be able to send those individuals an opt-out notice. If they don't respond, they're automatically registered. But we are not sending information to the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Okay. I'm just a little bit confused then with the Department of Revenue. How they, because it says in here that they would actually get the information that's shared. Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, do you know what section you're referring to?
Yes, I do. It would be section 3 on the second page. Maybe I'm just misreading it. And I guess it would probably start at line 14 under section 3.
I could refer to the bill sponsors, but my understanding, through the chair, Representative Allard, my understanding of this section is that the division receives the information from the Department of Revenue, Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and then we would use it for the purposes of voter roll maintenance, specific to what is described in section P of that section.
Okay, so... then that would mean the Department of Revenue has that information. But what's preventing Department of Justice, and maybe the sponsor could help us, the DOJ, from suing to get information from DOR?
Senator Wilkowski.
Are there mechanisms in place to prevent that from happening? Thank you, Senator.
I believe that would be a violation of both state and federal law.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think what we're going to do is go ahead and call it a day or a morning. We're going to set the bill aside and take it up again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And we'll take that up as the first order of business. And if we have time, then we'll go into the HB 280 apportion taxable income bill. And when we do come back in the queue, I know that Representative Galvin, Representative Shragi had asked for the name to be put on the list and then taken off, but I put them on again if you want the option, and then also Representative Bynum. And we'll come back to questions with Ms. Beecher and the sponsor of the bill. And we had intended to, I think we can still, we're going to still shoot for an amendment deadline of tomorrow night at 5 p.m. March 13th. But if it turns out that we just have more questions and we don't get the a comfort level tomorrow after our morning meeting, then we'll revisit that. So, but keep that in mind. If you do have amendments that you're thinking about, you can start working on those. And so with that, our next meeting is scheduled for today at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll be taking public testimony on the operating budget. Floor session, that is correct, at 2 o'clock. We do have floor session, and I think we've got...
We should confirm, I have some memory of my staff telling me we may try to spend 30 minutes between 1:30 and 2.
Doing public testimony.
So I think we're on for 1:30.
Okay.
Does that sound right?
Let's.
Floor is 2:30.
Floor is 2:30. Okay.
We're 30 minutes.
Okay, so let's plan to be here at 1:30, and then we might finish up a little earlier than that. But for folks watching, if you would like to submit public testimony on the operating budget, we are taking public testimony from the following communities, and that is Fairbanks, Kenai, Bethel, Cordova, Kotzebue, Nome, Ukiavik, and then the off-net calls. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 10:47 a.m. Thank you.